Hi, this is Newt. Due to the virus, I'm recording from home, so you may notice a difference in audio quality. On this episode of Newt's World, I'm taking a closer look at voter fraud and how it could affect the outcome of the 2020 election. You know, various folks on the left will tell you, oh, there's not really any voter fraud. I was probably affected because in the first campaign I was really involved in back in 1960, I remember late on election night, it was very, very close, one of the closest presidential elections in history. And then in Chicago, people voted who had actually been dead for a while. And down in the valley in Texas, people voted who didn't exist. And all of a sudden, Illinois and Texas both went for John F. Kennedy. Although in both cases, the margin was almost certainly voter fraud. So I've had a long career of being very worried about voter fraud. And the amazing thing is, for anybody who has any doubt, there is a place called the Heritage Foundation that has an extraordinary collection of information, and you could never look at it without realizing just how real and how dangerous voter fraud is. I'm pleased to welcome my guest, Hans von Spakovsky, an authority on a wide range of issues, including civil rights, civil justice, the First Amendment, immigration, the rule of law, and government reform. He's a senior legal fellow in the Heritage Foundation's Edwin Meads III Center for Legal and Judicial Studies. Hans von Spakovsky is one of the key people I turn to for advice on election law reform. Hans, why do you think the news media and the so-called public interest groups find it so hard to admit that there's fraud in the election process?
Well, this is a relatively new phenomenon. If you go back 30 years, it really wasn't like that. Back then, there was bipartisan concern over it. You could find stories about voter fraud cases, even in places like the New York Times. This is kind of a recent phenomenon, and it appears to have started when some state legislatures started saying, well, look, we really should try to pass measures that would give us more secure elections. And they started talking about things like requiring an ID when you vote, or requiring proof of citizenship when you register to vote, or states trying to compare their statewide voter registration list to find people who have registered more than one state. And I'm afraid that the problem may be that there are some who want to take advantage of the vulnerabilities in the system, and they don't like it when those vulnerabilities are addressed.
So do you think that's deliberate, willful ignorance on their part, or do you think they genuinely don't know?
I think on some folks, it's genuine ignorance of not understanding that there really is fraud, that it really happens. But I think on the other side, there are folks who they want us to have a system that can be taken advantage of. And the best example I can give you of that is several individuals were convicted of absentee ballot fraud in Troy, New York. One of them was a political consultant for the Democratic Party. And when he was asked by the police why they had targeted this one particular neighborhood, in essence, they went in and they stole the absentee ballots of voters, forged signatures, submitted them, and they picked a low-income housing neighborhood. And the consultant was interviewed by the police. When he was asked why they targeted that neighborhood, he said, well, it's because these are the individuals who are least likely to realize their vote's been stolen and least likely to complain about it. So I think that, unfortunately, says a lot about some of the political consultants that are involved in this kind of work.
And of course, the second line of defense they have is, well, there may be some minor theft or some minor distortion, but they don't really affect the outcome of the election. What's your experience when you look at them carefully?
That claim is simply not true. And the reason is that we have close elections all the time in this country. In fact, I was kind of astonished a couple of years ago when the Ohio Secretary of State put out a list of elections in his state that within the last 3 years had been decided either by one vote or a tie vote. There were over 140 such elections. And that's because the elections that we have many in this country down at the state and local level, everything from town council and county commission races to state legislative races, many of those are decided by a handful of elections, and that's where it can make the difference, like the mayor of Gordon, Alabama, who we just added to our database, who last year was removed from office because he engaged in absentee ballot fraud in an election that he won by only 16 votes.
What do you make of the aggressive effort right now to go to a universal vote-by-mail process? And how is that different from what we've had for a very long time, which is, for example, our troops overseas have been allowed to vote absentee, which is a mail-in ballot. So how do you see, one, the difference between the traditional way we've done absentee ballots and what the Democrats are proposing? And two, what do you think the outcome would be if they got the kind of universal direct mail system they want?
I think the kind of universal by mail system they want will cause huge problems because it would make our elections even more vulnerable to fraud and other problems. Look, right now you can vote by absentee ballot in 45 states in the District of Columbia. And nobody disputes that we need that for people who are physically disabled or sick, and particularly, as you mentioned, for our troops who are overseas and their families. But in those states, normally what you have to do is you have to request the absentee ballot. So you've got to fill out a form, you have to sign it. That gives election officials a little bit of a better opportunity to authenticate that it's a real request, that you are a real voter. Compare that to the five states that have put in all mail elections, and that's what's being pushed now by various folks to deal with the pandemic. In those states, like Oregon, they simply mail an absentee ballot to every single registered voter. Well, the problem with that is that registered voter lists all over the country are in terrible condition, and everybody knows that. The states don't do a very good job of cleaning up their voter rolls, which means that you have ballots being mailed out to registered voters who don't actually live at their addresses anymore because they've died or they've moved out of state. And that means you have a very valuable commodity floating around out there, and that's dangerous. And I can give you anecdotal evidence of this. Look, I have a colleague I work with. She grew up in Washington State, which has all mail elections. Her parents still live there. She hasn't lived there for years, neither have her sisters, yet the state still hasn't figured out that they are no longer living there. And her parents say that every single election, she and her sisters are mailed ballots. They could easily, if they wanted to, vote those ballots and send them in, despite the fact that they no longer live in the state. And it's very clear the state would never detect it and would never figure it out.
From that context, if we went to a universal system, wouldn't that be an invitation to massive amounts of fraud?
Yes, it would be. In states that legalize vote harvesting, you would have probably paid political consultants and others going through neighborhoods to collect the absentee ballot of people who no longer live there so that they could make sure that they get voted. Anybody who doubts that will happen, it's happened before and people have been prosecuted for it, but it's hard to detect.
Somebody also made the argument, I think it was MIT and Caltech in a study that they did, that when you get vote harvesting, because you're actually going out and seeing the person you're getting the ballot from, you really dramatically weaken the concept of a secret ballot because you have somebody looking over your shoulder. I was very surprised in California in 18 how huge the ballot harvesting had become and how many districts there were where the Republicans were ahead on election night, even by a pretty good number. And then you see it gradually erode day by day after that as these harvested ballots came in. Can you explain how that process works and why it should even be legal?
We've all seen that states have laws that ban electioneering at polling places. So candidates can't be there pressuring voters either inside a polling place or within a certain distance of it. There's no such rules with people's homes. And that means that in states like California that have legalized vote harvesting, what that means is they have made it legal for anyone to show up at your front door to pick up your absentee ballot and deliver it for you. So that means that candidates themselves can show up at your door, or people who work for the political parties or for campaigns. And that means that they are in a position to, one, break the secrecy of the ballot by seeing how you vote, and second, to put pressure on you or to actually intimidate you into voting a particular way. And again, there's nothing to prevent that because there's no supervision by election officials there. And anyone who doubts that can happen. In 2004, the Indiana State Supreme Court threw out an election in a small town in Indiana. Why? Because of that kind of illegal vote harvesting that was going on. And they describe in great detail in the court decision how these campaign organizations and people working for them went into people's homes and basically pressured them to vote for their candidate. And the court decision says they picked on people who were elderly and poor and who had poor English skills because apparently they were easier to manipulate. And that is one of the problems with going to an all-male election.
You could have the Democrats deciding that they would focus on the election rather than the campaign, because if they could steal enough votes, it wouldn't matter what happened in the campaign. And I see all these different provisions, both in H.R. 1, the first vote that the new Pelosi Congress took, and also in the recent proposed Pelosi $3 trillion bill. There's just item after item designed to loosen up the balloting and make it easier to steal. I mean, is that a reasonably accurate description?
Oh, no, I think that's exactly accurate. While some states like California allow vote harvesting, which I think is a very unwise policy, many states ban it. And yet this bill that Nancy Pelosi pushed through would force all states to allow vote harvesting. Now, remember, her bill was supposedly intended to deal with the coronavirus. Why would she put in a provision saying, well, it's now legal for anyone to come to your front door to pick up your ballot when we're supposed to be doing social distancing? That shows you that has absolutely nothing to do with dealing with the virus, but it has everything to do with, frankly, making it easier to steal elections. Another provision it had in it was forcing all states to allow same-day registration. What that means is that even if you're not registered to vote, you can register on election day and immediately vote. The reason that is an unwise policy is that most states require you to register 10, 20, 30 days before election, because that gives election officials the time to try to verify the information you're giving them on the voter registration form. If you register and immediately vote, there's no way to know whether you are a real person who really lives at the address where you have registered. And again, it's a way of increasing the vulnerability of the system to fraud.
Do you think that this is a deliberate strategy to maximize the ability to win an election in which you actually have a minority of the vote?
Yes, I think it is. And that's really shown by the fact that, remember, the very first thing that Democrats did when they took over the House after the 2018 election was their very first bill, H.R. 1, which obviously, therefore, was their most important bill, was a gigantic bill dealing with changing state election laws all over the country, everything from getting rid of voter ID laws to vote harvesting. They basically simply took all of those provisions and inserted them into the coronavirus bills that they put together. So it's very clear this is intended to help them manipulate election results. It has nothing to do with dealing with the pandemic.
What do you see happening? Because it's a 50 state plus District of Columbia sort of series of parallel fights, and there doesn't seem to be an overarching solution.
It is a state by state fight. Congress has not passed anything along the lines of what Nancy Pelosi has been pushing. Thank goodness. We don't need a federal takeover of state election laws, a state election administration. But there are fights going on in every single state, both in the state legislatures and in court. The other day, I got a list of the lawsuits that have been filed dealing with elections, and it's something like 50 pages long. I mean, it's a huge fight. There's a lot of money being put into this by a lot of foundations, including the George Soros people. And they are trying to change the election rules. the way elections are run in order to give them a political advantage and, frankly, increase the vulnerability of the system to manipulation. That's the fight that's happening everywhere.
I want to drive home for our listeners how very real this is, and the idea that you could have a senator or a governor or even a president whose election is decisively changed by how people manipulate and manage the turnout and make sure that they have enough votes in there even if they didn't win them. I've been in politics a long time. I don't remember anything this bad and this openly, blatantly willing to be illegal that I've seen literally in my lifetime. What's your sense of what's ultimately driving this?
I think they've gotten to the point where they believe the end justifies the means, and that folks like Donald Trump and others are just so terrible in their minds that anything they do to win is justified, even if it means cheating. And I hate to see that attitude because I don't think their constituents agree with them. And the reason I say that is liberal politicians are just overwhelmingly against, for example, the common sense reform of voter ID. But if you look at the polling on this, the American public, regardless of their political party, regardless of their race or ethnicity, all think voter ID is something that ought to be in place, that it's a common sense reform. So it's very clear that the constituency doesn't agree with some of the views you see in the political leadership.
I look at the rise of California and New York and the scale of money going into it and the size of the machine they're building. This is going to be very uphill, both to make sure we get an honest election, that we have an honest ballot system. It's not at all automatic as of right now.
Exactly right. And just a quick example of that is the fact that, look, there's evidence that non-citizens are illegally registering and voting in states all over the country. And yet every time states have tried to do something about that, states like Kansas, Arizona, Georgia, and have tried to put in provision that would give states the ability to, for example, require proof of citizenship when folks register to vote, an all-out battle has erupted in the court, again, spurred on by liberal groups, to prevent states from doing that.
I want to get into this whole question of whether or not, because of COVID-19, it's too dangerous for people to go and actually cast a ballot. Because, as you know, the left wants to use this as one of their arguments for why we have to change how we've been doing things.
Right.
What's your take on that whole argument?
Well, I actually published a paper taking a look at the fact that Liberia held a national election in 2014 in the midst of the Ebola epidemic that was hitting West Africa. And what I did is contrasted all of the safety protocols they put in place. And it's interesting because, as you know, Liberia, the main language is English. So the training manual that they put out for their poll workers is in English and available from their National Election Commission. And it's very much the same as the training manual put out by the Wisconsin Election Commission for their April 7th primary. And it goes into great detail about doing everything from line spacing with the voters to using disposable voting materials, etc. The Secretary General said that Liberia had a very successful election. They didn't see any spike in Ebola infections because of the election. And the same thing happened in Wisconsin. There were 1.5 million voters. 300,000 of them voted in person in Wisconsin. The reports out indicate that there's been no spike in COVID-19 infections. And again, it's because they put in all the same kind of safety protocols in the polling places that we are seeing when we all go to the grocery store, retail establishments. In fact, they were much more elaborate there. Similarly, South Korea held national elections on April 15th. 29 million South Koreans voted. Again, there, health officials have put out a report and statement saying there's been no spike in COVID-19 infections. The point of all this is in-person elections have been held under similar, in fact, worse conditions without problems. And I don't see any reason why we can't do the same, certainly the November elections, when in fact, large parts of the country are already reopening for business.
You would think that if Liberia can figure out how to have a safe election when dealing with Ebola, that surely a country of the sophistication of the United States ought to be able to hold a relatively safe election by this November if we plan ahead and think it through.
3 weeks ago, I voted in person. I live in the town of Vienna, Virginia. We had our town council mayoral elections. I voted in person in the polling place assigned to me in the town. And I felt safer in the polling place than I have felt when I go to the grocery store because of the very elaborate precautions that they took. The other thing we should keep in mind is we all know from COVID-19 has been for the elderly and others with compromised immune systems. And in almost every single state, like Texas, for example, where there's been a huge fight because they are an excuse absentee balloting state, the excuse requirement doesn't apply to people 65 and over. So those residents of Texas who want to vote by absentee ballot who are over 65 and most at risk, they're going to be able to do that. There's no reason for the state to move to an all-male election.
Given the number of counties that have more registered voters than they have adults, at what point do you get just a huge pool of stealable votes?
Well, if you're mailing out an absentee ballot to every registered voter, and you know that the voter lists are filled with individuals who should no longer be on there, you're talking about a huge number of ballots. You may recall in 2008, when the U.S. Supreme Court upheld Indiana's voter ID law, the court said that the estimates given to it of the amount of inaccuracies or ineligible individuals on the voter rolls in Indiana was close to 40%.
Wow. Having looked at all of this around the country, and you're clearly one of the preeminent experts on election law and on election fraud, why do you think the Democrats seem to be almost universally so committed to creating a relatively easy to steal election system? Is this a coherent strategy?
I think for people deep within the political consulting world who make their living on political campaigns, it is a strategy because they believe it will help them to win elections. If I can again go back to Troy, New York, where several locals were convicted of voter fraud, including a political consultant who worked for Democratic candidates there. And when he was interviewed by the police, one of the things he said was, "This is the way things are done here. This has been going on for years in election after election." So that was their way of winning elections. Similarly, the U.S. attorney that covers Philadelphia just indicted and just convicted, he pled guilty, a local election official there who was literally stuffing the ballot box. And why was he doing it? He'd been bribed to do it by a local political consultant on behalf of that political consultant's clients, who we knew were, for example, Democratic judicial candidates and potentially other candidates in Pennsylvania. So this had been happening in multiple elections. This was not a one-time thing.
Was the consultant also indicted?
Not yet, but we've only just gotten the first indictment. And it's very clear that the election official who was actually stuffing the ballot, he was the low guy on the totem pole. I'm sure he's now going to be used to testify against the political consultant as the Justice Department rolls up what was clearly a conspiracy here. So I assume the consultant will be next in line. And after that, we're just going to have to see who else is potentially indicted.
In your judgment, have we been seeing a gradual decay of the system? I mean, it seemed to me at one point it was a relatively honest system.
Yes, I think we have seen a decay. And one of the reasons for it is in the last two decades, states have quit trying to clean up their voter rolls. Because every time they actually try to go in and take off people who have died and moved away and otherwise become ineligible to vote, they are inevitably sued by very well-funded liberal organizations saying you're trying to purge active and eligible voters, even though that's not what they are doing. So many state election officials have just gotten to the point where they don't have the time and the resources to fight lawsuits like that. So they just don't do anything about it. And that's one of the reasons the voter registration lists seem to be getting worse every year.
I thought there's a federal law that requires you to purge the list.
There is. It's a provision under the National Voter Registration Act, but it's very vague. It simply says you have to do regular maintenance on the voter list. During the entirety of the Clinton administration and the Obama administration too, they did not file a single federal lawsuit for states to clean up their voter rolls, states that weren't doing it. In fact, the Bush administration actually did file the first lawsuits to enforce that provision. One of those lawsuits was still pending against, I think it was Missouri, when the Obama administration came in and they almost immediately dismissed the federal lawsuit with no publicity, no press release like they usually put out anytime they take any action. They actually literally dismissed the suit.
And isn't it true that when the Trump administration tried to set up a commission to look at election law and fraudulent voting, that they were just hammered with lawsuits from liberal organizations?
Yeah, the president set up a presidential advisory commission on election integrity. I was actually appointed as one of the members. As you well know, Mr. Speaker, those commissions have no actual executive power. All they can do is research and report and make recommendations. And yet you would have thought the sky had fallen in. The whole point of the commission was to research the issue, come up with recommendations, and they were flooded with more than a dozen lawsuits to prevent them from being able to operate, and unfortunately was effective in doing that.
Listen, thank you. This has been terrific. The work you're doing is really important, and we will continue to try to highlight it and direct people towards your projects at Heritage.
Well, I appreciate that very much, and thank you for having me on.
Thank you to my guest, Hans von Spakovsky. You can read more about potential voter fraud in the 2020 election on our show page at newtsworld.com. Newts World is produced by Gingrich 360 and iHeartMedia. Our executive producer is Debbie Myers, and our producer is Garnsey Sloan. The artwork for the show was created by Steve Pendler. Special thanks to the team at Gingrich 360. Please email me with your questions at gingrich360.com/questions. I'll answer them in future episodes. If you've been enjoying Newts World, I hope you'll go to Apple Podcasts and both rate us with 5 stars and give us a review so others can learn what it's all about. On the next episode of Newt's World, The War on America, this has been a very challenging time. And I want you to know that I think it's not obvious what's been going on. It requires real research and real thought. I frankly have been more cautious than usual in speaking out, because I wanted to make sure I really understood all the different patterns we're currently faced with. I'm Newt Gingrich. This is Newt's World.